My name's Millie Lake. It's the 5th of November 2010, 3:30 p.m., and this is for the Establishing Brand Responsibility Oral and Digital History Project. If I could please just ask you to state your name and position for the record, and then tell us a little bit about your role here at the University of Washington, how you came here, and what you're...
So, my name is Norm Arkins. I'm the Associate Vice President for Media Relations and Communications at the University, and I have been a member of the Advisory Committee on Trademarks and Licensing virtually from its inception, I don't remember, probably 15 years ago when the first committee was established. I don't have the exact dates, but you can check that. I used to be, at one point, an assistant to the president, Ben McCormick, with responsibilities for helping to oversee the athletic department, and for a number of years, probably 15 years, the trademarks and licensing program at the university actually reported to me. So I've been involved in issues surrounding university trademarks, trademarked products being produced in better working conditions, sweat-free working conditions, and so forth, for probably 15 years.
Okay, and could you tell us a little bit then about how you got interested in that particular issue and came to be involved with
it? Well, I got interested in it because I was instrumental in getting the committee established. The at colleges and universities around the country, these issues have basically been brought before universities by students. It was, you know, universities themselves. University administrations have not sat around and said, gee, what problem should we tackle today? The issue was raised on college campuses across the country by U.S. Students Get Sweatshops, Washington Students Get Sweatshops, as they were called here, which was the precursor to the current organization called SLAP, Student Labor Action Project. And so the students here at the time became active, and like other students around the country, were pressuring the administration to do something. I think the first impetus was they wanted us to align with the Worker Rights Consortium, which at the time was very new and very formative. And so out of those discussions, out of the pressure that the students brought, the university decided that we needed to put together this committee with student representation. So we put together that first advisory committee, made some decisions about aligning both with the Worker Rights Consortium. We had joined the Fair Labor Association prior to the committee ever being established. We became aware of it. We affiliated with it as a university. Students were not happy that we had done that. They wanted us actually initially to quit Fair Labor Association, align with the Worker Rights Consortium. We decided that both organizations, fledgling as they were and new, both with the promise to try to influence conditions under which college licensed merchandise were made, we felt that we wanted to sort of maximize our chances of having some influence, and the way to do that was to join both and watch them and see how they progressed and sort of monitor it on a periodic basis to make sure to see whether it was worth continuing to be a member of both. So that's how we got started. It was initially part of my job.
Okay, thank you. And could you just speak a little bit more about what your responsibilities are as a member of ACTL, how often you meet,
Sure. So the advisory committee, let's see, initially it probably met once a month, every couple of weeks, depending on the work. It had a lot of work to do initially. There were lots of strains and stresses initially because I think there was a perception among the students that there was not a convergence of views between them and the administration. I think that was partly not necessarily a fully accurate perception. I think we had very similar goals in mind, but maybe different strategies and methods for reaching those goals. And then the initial group of students graduated. And and we reached a point where there was just not a lot of momentum on campus, and the committee actually fell into a little moribund status. And then we got a new group of students, which we do, of course, every year, and they became more active again, and were wondering what happened to the committee. So we reinvigorated the committee, restructured it under President Hammer, refreshed its membership, established new chairs, and the committee for the past three or four years has been really pretty active. We meet, I think, on a monthly basis. There were times when we met more frequently, but it sort of depends on the work that goes on. And the work of the committee, which you probably heard from others, is to help the university look at its relationship with companies that produce products in its name, look at our code of conduct and see whether, in fact, our code of conduct has kept pace with changes in the industry and whether we need to make changes to the code of conduct, hold companies that make products with our name on them accountable for complying with our code of conduct. I think part of what we found, which we may get into, is that there are some issues there. That sort of issue certainly came up with Nike because our code of conduct hasn't been revised in quite a long time. There are parts of it that might be a little bit ambiguous. And so when we were examining what Nike was doing to try to solve the problem in Honduras, one of the things that emerged was, you know, it wasn't clear exactly what our code of conduct asked companies to do. And so we are in the process now, as we speak, of revising the code of conduct, updating it, and you're probably aware that other members are talking about that. That's one of our work objectives this year, is to look at the code of conduct, modernize it, update it, make sure that it does what we want it to do. And then we use that to try to hold companies accountable when we become aware that there are legitimate allegations or allegations with some foundation and basis in reality and fact that we need to pay attention to. And that's a hard thing for a university to do because no university can do that on its own. That's the reason why you had these consortia form. That's the reason the Worker Rights Consortium form is the reason the FLA form, because none of us are in the business of being able to monitor compliance. We don't have the staff, we don't have the expertise, we don't have the wherewithal. We occasionally have faculty and students who are interested in this, and they develop a certain level of expertise, and they go, like Angelina Victoria and her students, will go visit a country and be able to be on the ground and look. But from a systematic perspective, there's not a university on earth that can do this on its own. The collective will and power of universities through these consortia have been what we've been able to do. And so we have to rely on both the Fair Labor Association, Worker Rights Consortium, some of the NGOs that are in this business that are monitoring compliance with various codes of conduct. We have to rely on them to bring to light problems and issues that occur. We've had some notable problems and issues with some companies and some success in having those companies address them. But, you know, if you think about it, the things that we've paid attention to and found are probably the tip of the iceberg. I mean, it's a huge, complicated... I think the one thing that all of us have been involved with is we don't study it as a subject of scholarship, but the one thing is that it's a huge supply chain out there, very complicated relationships between suppliers, manufacturers, brands, factory owners, etc., complicated by national and international laws, and it's really a pretty big mess. And so I think that, you know, the United States, I don't know what goes on in other countries, I don't know what goes on in Britain or France or some of the other Western economies, but I know in the United States, which is home to many of the brands, I think it's gotten marginally better. Is it where it needs to be? Absolutely not. Are people getting paid reasonable living wages around the world to produce these things that we're aware of? Absolutely not. I think, you know, how you view the success of that depends on your philosophy of incremental improvement and advancement in a really complicated situation. That went far afield, didn't it?
No, that was perfect. Thank you. No, that's all great. And we'll get into some of those issues in greater depth shortly. So maybe we can talk about the specific factory closures and then the negotiations between Nike and CGT and the role of Actor in that process.
Okay.
Could you talk about how the matter initially came to the attention of either yourself or Actor as a body?
Yeah, my recollection may not, I'm sure, is not perfect, and there are others, I think, who were more involved directly in some of the issues. Margaret, certainly, Kathy Hogan, who directs the Trademarks and License Council, was much more directly involved in these things. I think the issue in Honduras became a national issue. How are we doing?
Yeah, no, okay.
I think the issue in Honduras became a national issue, and I don't know whether it was first brought to attention through the Worker Rights Consortium or through others or through workers in Honduras who were hoping to get some relief from some of the things they didn't get when the factories closed and came to the United States. But it came to our attention, I think, largely because of the national attention it was getting, and then the sort of national student pipeline that reaches our students here, and we had this issue.
Okay, thank you. And could you summarize the key issues that were of concern or under consideration by ACTL with regard
to Nike? Yeah, I think the biggest issue is one I've alluded to already, and that is, did we have a code violation? And it got very complicated as, you know, you're piecing the story together from various members, and as I try to pull parts of my recollection out, you know, there were questions about whether these factories were actually producing collegiate product. There was conflicting evidence from different sources around the country and in Honduras. There were issues whether if they did produce college product, whether Nike was actually producing product for the University of Washington there, because that's how far our code went, right? It's producing product for us, and it wasn't clear, and people believe different things. I don't think it was ever clear, at least to my satisfaction, the extent to which Nike did or did not produce University of Washington product in these factories. So that led to the sort of dilemma over, well, if they did, we might have a code violation. If they didn't, we might not have a code violation. The code was pretty clear. There was a provision in the code that was pretty clear that the licensee, in this case Nike, would be responsible for, I think, and not quite in this language, but the gist is that they would be responsible for ensuring that those with whom it did business complied with our code. And there was that responsibility there. They didn't have responsibility necessarily to remediate it, but they were responsible for those that with whom they might subcontract to be sure that in the production, regardless of who was doing it, in the production of these products for the University of Washington, that those people would be compliant with our code. So that was clear. The question was whether that provision, that one provision of our code applied, because we couldn't determine, I think, to some of us on the committee, to our satisfaction, we couldn't determine really whether University of Washington products had been produced at those factories or not.
Okay, so I think you've kind of talked about this a little already, but in the process of reaching the unanimous decision to recommend to President Emmett to put Nike on formal notice, could you say something about the kinds of discussions that took place, what that process looked like?
Well, it was, I mean, it's a lot of what I just went over. Did we have a code? I mean, the fundamental question was, did we actually have a code violation? And there were those on the committee who felt we absolutely did. There were those on the committee who I don't think there was anyone who felt we absolutely did not, because it just wasn't clear. I mean, I was I voted for that. I was ambivalent about whether we actually had a code violation, and you know, we tried very hard as a committee to get the best information we could, both from Nike directly, because we were in direct communication with them, and with others at the Workers' Rights Consortium to try to, and of course the WRC felt that there was absolutely a code violation. And so we just never got, to, at least to my satisfaction, we never got good information as to whether we had product produced there. And but, you know, in the conversation, people felt that even if we didn't, the spirit of the code was being violated, and that we ought to put them on notice. We did not vote ever to suspend them as a licensee. I think we felt that we needed to make a statement that we were very concerned about what was going on, and that the benefits and the settlements to which the workers in Honduras were entitled in some way be met, and that while some of us, myself included, didn't expect Nike to meet those, we did expect Nike, with its power, to exert pressure on those responsible for those factories to do it. And I think we felt, and my, you know, mind you, I don't know that business, and none of us, there were some of us who didn't presume to try to know that business and what the relationships were, but we felt that, you know, as such a huge and powerful brand, that Nike could send a signal to these particular entities, one of which didn't exist anymore. I mean, they were out of business. They went bankrupt. They were out of business. But could send a message to its partners that they needed to meet their responsibilities under the laws in the countries in which they operated, or else Nike wasn't going to do business with them. I mean, that we felt that they had that ability to exert that kind of power.
Okay, thanks. That's great. Could you say something about your interaction with students during this process, if you had interaction with
in the committee, the discussions were good, participatory. Around that table, everybody is an equal. We're all members of the committee. And, you know, as I've said before, and as I said earlier here, the whole issue that of trying to improve the conditions under which these products are made wouldn't be an issue for universities if the students didn't bring them to our attention. I mean, that's plain fact. Mm-hmm. And so, and I think to a person, we all want those conditions to improve. Sometimes we have different views of the tactics. So, you know, over the course of time, I think students became impatient with the pace of progress. That's not untypical. We tend to move a little slower than students are comfortable with, and so there'll be some demonstrations and some picketing and some visits to the president's office and some depositing of petitions and so forth. But I think the communications were pretty open, and I think students on this campus, I hope students on this campus feel they can express themselves on any subject, and I think they do. Mm-hmm. And we try to be responsive where we think we can be responsive.
Okay, thank you. And you also talked about being in direct contact with Nike during this process. Could you say a little bit more?
So Margaret, the chair of the committee, and others had, we had visitations from Nike representatives. I forget their names, but we had a couple of Nike representatives who work in corporate responsibility and the like come and actually meet with the committee and speak with the committee, tell us what they were doing. I think they came at least once or twice. We had Kathy and Margaret, I think, had many phone conversations with them. We had exchanges of correspondence periodically. President Emmert was able to communicate with people at Nike, both in writing and I think in conversations about what he hoped Nike would do to try to work on this issue and solve this issue. I think his participation in trying to get a resolution of this was absolutely critical. I don't think, I mean, I don't know, I really was not privy to the discussions he had with Nike or discussions he and Margaret may have had with folks at Nike, but I think it's unmistakable that had he not been active, we probably wouldn't be sitting here with the result that we got. I mean, to Nike's credit, they moved and did what they needed to do to solve the issue, and they deserve credit for that. And I think to our credit, our university, for better or worse, was sort of relentless in trying to keep Nike working towards a solution.
Okay, thank you. So I just wondered what your knowledge was during this process of the positions that other universities have been taking and how much communication you had with other universities?
No, we were aware, not a whole lot. You know, there weren't that many universities who did much. I think Wisconsin, they had a committee similar to ours, and their chancellor, I think, sent a letter to Nike, I think. Was it Cornell, the other institution, that took some action? There, you know, at one point, we thought part of the reason why we weren't making a whole lot of progress was because there weren't that many universities around that were doing this. I mean, it was different from other issues where you had a lot of universities putting pressure on a company or on an issue. But this one was difficult because it was, as I mentioned earlier, because there were things that just weren't clear cut about it. And some felt that, gee, you know, if one of them was still in existence, you could do, but you can't go after an entity that's bankrupt and going out of business. They have no assets. And so, we were not, to my knowledge, we didn't necessarily confer with them. We were aware of what they were doing. And I presume they were aware of what we were doing. But we were pretty much operating, in my view, independently and on our own.
Thank you. I wonder if I could ask you to speculate, and probably will be speculation, on why Nike ultimately reached the decision it did, what role universities had to play in that.
It is pure speculation. I mean, that's a great question to put to Nike. You know, it's interesting, and I think there are different views about this. From the beginning, from 15 years ago, Nike, in the students' minds, I think, and I don't want to speak for them because they're certainly capable of speaking for themselves, but Nike, because it's so large and because it's so visible and because it's so successful, has been the poster child in many respects for all that's wrong in the supply chain out there. I think that's to some extent unfair. I think that among companies, Nike has taken the corporate responsibility issue about as seriously as anybody. It's, you know, as I said earlier, this is a hugely complex arena, and there are thousands of factories out there that are making stuff, and Nike can try to know what's going on in some of the factories, but it's not controlling the factories, and there are bad things happening in factories that they just don't know about. And so, they get tabbed for it because there's some local manager who's a thug and a pig and treats women badly or hires underage children and so forth. You know, their corporate responsibility program is supposed to ferret that stuff out, and they're not supposed to do business with people who operate factories like that. So, but on the one hand, I think students from the beginning, activist students, United Students Against Sweatshops and so forth, have vilified Nike because they're such an easy, visible target. I think Nike deserves more credit. I think that in this instance, and this is pure speculation, so you're sitting down there in Beaverton, Oregon, and you're saying, well, so this issue's not going to go away. It looks as if these universities are serious about it. From a financial perspective, this is not a big deal in Nike's. I mean, we are such a small fraction of what they do economically. perceptually, of course, it's bigger because Nike sponsors lots of sports and lots of college sports teams, and they get, you know, lots of visibility as a result, and college students represent for them, I presume, a huge and ever-growing future market for whatever products they're going to make. And so, you know, I could see them saying, you know, this is a thorn, and, you know, we can either continue to deal with this for another 6 months or a year or however long, or we can fix it. And the fix is not going to be that expensive. Nike's overall bottom line, the fix is not that expensive. And they could send a message to companies that they engage with, factory operators they engage with, that, you know, we're not going to do, you know, we're not going to work with you if you're going to do this sort of thing. So I think it was my speculation, I want to emphasize that, is that it was a way for them to make the issue go away, way for them to take some steps to move positively, and it really didn't cost them a lot of money.
Okay, thank you.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense.
You don't have to say that.
No, it's great. And just on that note, to follow up a little bit, do you believe that this action by Nike does set a precedent at all for the future, for them, for other companies?
I think that's one of the things they were probably worried about. You know, was that it sets a precedent. Because they, you know, they're not going to, every time somebody that they engage with misbehaves, they're not going to step in and pay money to fix it. I mean, I understand that from a business perspective. If I operated a business, I wouldn't want to be in that position either. But I think what they might be trying to do, and certainly what we're all trying to do, is to send a message that, you know, if you operate a factory and you're one of our subcontractors and you don't let people have conversations about organizing, if you're not paying minimum wage in your country, if you're violating your country's laws, we, Nike, are not going to do business with you. You will not have the privilege of producing our product. And I think that's a good message for them to be sending.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
So I just have three further questions that kind of follow up on things that we've touched on already.
Okay.
The first one is, I wondered if you talked at all in the committee amongst the members of ACTA and in your discussions about what the consequences, well, I'm sure you talked about this, but what the consequences were for the university of letting the contract expire and what other options might have been open to the university.
So, I don't think we talked about the consequences. I mean, the consequences of letting the contract expire had Nike not done anything, had the president of the university at the time the contract would have expired. Of course, that wouldn't, it's Phyllis, but she can't because of her putting this wall. So it would have been probably our senior vice president for business and finance is the person who would have had to make that decision. So the consequences would have been that people in Seattle wouldn't have Nike product purchase. The university's trademarks and licensing revenue would take a hit.
Mm-hmm.
Not insignificant, not earth-shattering, but not insignificant, because I think Nike's probably our biggest licensee revenue producer. Kathy Hogan would know that for sure. And it would be complicated because we're a Nike school with regard to separate contracts, separate units. We're a Nike school in the sense that they're our sole supplier for athletic uniforms and equipment and so forth. So it would have been interesting to see what Nike would have thought of that, because on the one hand, we've got a 10-year contract with them to supply our athletic teams. On the other hand, we tell them you can't make a Nike product for our fans to buy. That would have caused a problem, but I don't think any of us really figured that out or speculated all that much about it. We were very hopeful that Nike would find a way to solve this without having the licensing agreement expire. And part of the reason that I think we went in that direction was to give them some time to work it out, you know, rather than just throwing down the gauntlet and saying, you got 2 weeks to fix it. If you don't fix it, you're out. And I think some students wanted us to do that, and my view is that rarely gets you anywhere. I think that the collaboration and trying to work through a complicated problem, even if it takes a lot of time. You know, the case preceding Nike, I forget the
Russell or SFL?
No, it was prior, the one a couple of years ago before Russell, where it was in Guatemala, I think, where we had, where we weren't really even a player in the game, but our trademarks and licensing program got involved. And it took us, where we were trying to get workers pay that they had been deprived of, that they were entitled to, that NGOs and everybody else had found that they were entitled to. It probably took 8 months of negotiating, multiple party negotiations involving the WRC, the FLA, the university, and others. And it probably took 8 months to get them to pay. And when they settled, I think the total amount was probably a little over $1 million, and they ended up agreeing to pay $600,000. You know, so it wasn't, and some of the students didn't want us to stop short of the full number. But, you know, at some point you have to say, you have to evaluate it and say, is this the best we can do? Do we think we're really, this is as far as we're going to push them? And if it's as far as you can push them, my view is take it, because it's way further than where you were when you started. And so, I forget what your question was, but I think, in any case, I think that it takes some compromise, as it always does. It takes some time. These things take longer than anybody wants them to. But if you can work together, I know, yeah, if you can work together to try to inch towards a solution, it's better than not. And so in this case, I think saying to them, we're going to let the thing expire if you haven't shown some demonstration of really making progress to solving this thing.
Yeah, so you kind of hinted at this, but were you surprised at that outcome then, at Nike's decision to settle this summer, or how did you respond?
I don't think I was surprised. I really didn't have any way of predicting that that's where they were going to end up. Mm-hmm. So that was not on my individual, and I'm not an expert in this stuff at all. We have some experts on the committee, Asim and Margaret and some other faculty who study this, but I'm not an expert on this. It hadn't occurred to me that the route they took was a route that was a solution to it. And so that sort of wasn't on my radar screen. I was very pleased when they did it, because it seemed like a good solution. It seemed as if they could maintain their principles. It seemed as if people weren't going to look, and maybe it's naive, people weren't going to look to them to just buy out all the problems and solve it with money. But it also dealt with the issue in a straightforward, meaningful way, which is what everybody wanted to begin with, you know.
Okay, that's great. So I just have one final question, which builds on something that you talked about at the beginning about the code of conduct being reformed this year. I wondered if you had any thoughts you were able or wanted to share with us about what kind of reforms you want to see in that regard.
Oh, well, it's I think it's probably been 10 years since we adopted that. And it was fairly early on, and we modeled it, I think, on the FLA code of conduct, because that's the first organization we joined. I think there have been advancements in the whole area of American companies trying to hold production facilities accountable. And so I think we want to take a look and make sure that with regard to women's rights, with regard to prohibition of child work, with regard to, I don't think anybody's really figured out what a living wage is, and maybe that concept has, we've moved beyond that maybe to something that's a fair wage, which may be different from a living wage, because, so there have been scholarly developments in these things where, and I think there were some, as we saw in the Nike case, some areas that just need better defining so we don't find ourselves in these sort of tight spots again. So it needs, I mean, you ought to look at anything every 10 years to see whether it needs updating. It needs updating, and we want to make sure that it's consistent with where the whole industry has moved, and that we don't have something that's old. And we also want it to be, I think, relatively similar to other codes of conduct that other universities and other organizations like the WRC and FLA have. Because if we all go out there and have separate codes of conduct with all these different provisions, it's going to drive the companies nuts. Right? But they want to be able to look at codes of conduct across universities and say, yeah, we can deal with these, and to have them be basically similar, not necessarily identical at all, but basically similar. So that's what we're looking at.
Okay, that's great. And was there anything else that you wanted to share for the public record that we haven't kind of touched on so far?
No, I think I've alluded to it. I think I've been really proud of our students. It's been a long and sort of up and down ride. There have been some students over the course of the past 10 or 15 years who have been more vociferous and more demanding and more impatient and maybe in some cases a little more rigid. The students that we've had on the, both from Student Labor Action Project, from the ASUW and GPSS, our student government organizations, have been really knowledgeable and engaged and informed. And so I think, if you step back and look at it institutionally, I think I've been very proud of our students because it's an issue about which they're passionate. It's an issue that needs addressing. It's an issue that that universities, as I said, several times already, it's not something we would just, without the students, say, gee, we ought to go take a look at. And it's an issue where we can try to influence through American consumer behavior to some extent the conditions under which these products are made. What has surprised me, and don't tell anybody this, what has surprised me to some extent is that, and this will happen, I think it's starting to happen now, but this will happen, but it surprised me sitting sort of as an observer in these things, that we're all focused on the factory where the goods are manufactured, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's there's a whole world out there, right? Of who's picking the cotton, under what, right? There's a supply chain that starts with planting the cotton plant, right? So you're a scholar, right? Right? There's all, right? And nobody's talking about that.
Yeah.
Nobody's talking about. So when we get done with the factories,
mm-hmm.
in about 50 years, or however long it takes, it'll take, and I do have another observation. When we get done with the factories, somebody's going to say, well, where's all this cotton coming from? And who's planting the cotton? And who's picking the cotton? And I don't know the answer to that. I really don't. My guess is, there's a huge population of child labor out in the cotton fields in the third world picking cotton. And if we saw the conditions under which that cotton was being harvested, we'd be appalled. That's my assumption. And none of us are sitting here with, right, I wear 100% cotton every day. None of us are sitting here saying, where's the cotton come from? The other thing that maybe this is one of those just insoluble problems, but one of the other things that has puzzled me over time is that, in this country, we didn't get safety regulations. In fact, when we were a manufacturing country, when we used to make this stuff, and in Britain, I'm sure it's true too, in the 19th century Dickens era, where we didn't get good laws governing safety, working conditions, minimum wage, etc. Well, we didn't get improvements in those conditions until we had laws that were passed and entities put in place to monitor those laws, like OSHA and so forth. And I think until we can reach some global treaty solutions, country by country, to establish some legal standards. You know, this is all voluntary codes of conduct and compliance. And countries have laws. Some of them are better than others. But until we have some international treaties that where countries sign on and agree that they're going to have laws with basic standards and that they're going to enforce those laws with basic standards, all of the work that we're that you're chronicling now is really just pushing the edges. That's my fear, is that it's really just making improvements on the margins, and that we can continue to make improvements on the margins for 50 years and see some progress. But until there are some enforceable international treaties that govern this arena, which I think will be very hard to get to, it's going to continue to be a problem.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah,
absolutely. Because this is your field of study, not my field of study.
No, absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
You don't have to agree just because you're here.
No, I totally agree. That's actually one of the issues that I'm looking at in my own research, is the interaction between international and domestic law.
Until somebody can hold countries accountable under international treaties and agreements, it really is just sort of... I mean, I think it's worth working on the margins. I really do. I think you make improvements where you can improve them. And if you do it one factory at a time, that's one factory less that you have to worry about. You know? It's just a long road if you do it one factory at a time.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.